Welcome to Season 5 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we are further expanding our knowledge by speaking to experts in the fields of physiology, psychology, nutrition, strength and conditioning, and mindset training. We'll be speaking to the coaches and practitioners who do this every day, and to the researchers and academics who are at the forefront of the sciences. Today, our guest is Taylor Ryan. Taylor is an accredited sports dietitian and owner of the Sports Dietitian Co., one of Australia's most successful sports nutrition clinics that focuses on strength sports. Taylor predominantly works with athletes from the recreational to the elite in CrossFit, powerlifting and weightlifting, but also works with athletes in team, endurance and combat sports. Alongside her success in the world of performance nutrition, Taylor is a leader in the area of energy availability and makes a real effort to make athletes aware of the negative health and performance outcomes that can occur when they underfuel for prolonged periods of time. In this episode, we discuss everything energy availability, what it is, why you need to know about it, what low energy availability is, how that can lead to relative energy deficiency, and how this affects a number of different systems in the body. Taylor breaks this down in both a real-world and mechanistic sense, so this episode is perfect for everyone from the enthusiast to the seasoned practitioner. There's so much good info to get through, so let's get to it. All right, green light means we are live to back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Now, joining me today, a very special guest and a good friend of mine, Taylor Ryan. You might know her better as the sports dietitian. Really big following on social media, and probably I would say the go-to dietitian in the CrossFit world, in the strength sport world. Taylor, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a good introduction there, Jordy.
Yeah, that was good. I just came up with that on the fly too. Didn't even read off my note. But Taylor, the reason I got you on today, because I always come to you. I always come to you for a lot of advice in an area that I think is hugely important, massively important in the sports nutrition world. Always has been, but I guess especially in the last few years as it's kind of come to light on just how little we know about it. And that's female athletes, female physiology, this topic about energy availability, more importantly, low energy availability. The reason why I've gotten you on is to kind of clear this up and to give a perspective from you, someone who is a practitioner and someone who's doing this on the ground every day, probably in one of the most successful clinics across Australia, to see how does this all tie together and what does this actually look like when we're, okay, practitioners are trying to assess this. And if you're an athlete, if you're listening going, okay, well, what am I looking out for? Or, you know, these might be signs and symptoms you weren't aware of. So I guess, Taylor, let's just get straight into it and let's just dive in. I think the first question, and it's probably the easiest one to start with, is just let's clear up energy availability. Can you give us a little definition and explain it to us?
Sure. So putting it in the most simplistic terms, energy availability basically means energy intake, obviously measured through our calories. And then what we do is we minus exercise energy expenditure. And then we divide that by our fat-free mass, and that's measured in kilograms. So as we know with most of these, when it comes to that basic, equation, when we're trying to determine this ourselves or even as an athlete, there's a lot of detailed analysis that needs to go in actually determining the correct energy intake and expenditure. So we know in theory, and you would know this too even in practice, that it's quite laborious and prone to a lot of inaccuracy. So before a lot of people even start or even try to determine their requirements, if they've got a lot of, lack of knowledge or knowledge deficit in terms of how to interpret that correctly, you can already see that they're setting themselves up for failure in that instance. So the biggest problem when it comes to once we determine what that energy availability is that when it comes to our athletic population, if they're eating too low to what they need on a day-to-day basis with everything they're doing, that obviously puts the athlete and the individual at risk of low energy availability, which I know we'll talk, and the long-term health consequences associated with this, if that makes sense.
Can you talk to us about, and these are used interchangeably and probably quite confusingly for people listening, energy balance and energy availability. Can you talk to us, what are they and what are the differences?
Okay, so when we're talking about energy balance, it's obviously talking about how much calories we consume versus how much we expend. So obviously when it's equal, we have a maintenance there. So that's quite easy to determine because obviously you don't see any changes in your weight, no fluctuations or anything, and you can maintain that, standard weight that we see. When you see a negative energy balance, and I feel like this is where a lot of people get confused with negative energy balance and then, about energy availability or LEA, so low energy availability, is because some people think that these terms are interrelated. So the problem with that is when we're talking about negative and negative energy balance, obviously we're talking about, most of the time, people would be aware of this as a calorie deficit. So where, like, less food or energy is taken in than is expended in metabolism. So as a result, that ends up in a decrease in body weight, correct? So then what ends up happening is most of the time low energy availability can be associated with negative energy balance and weight loss, but not necessarily all the time. So what we end up seeing is when someone starts or is exposed to LEA, they treat it very similar to, you know, when you're going through a calorie deficit. So you've created a reduction in your food, or you've either increased your energy expenditure or both. And then you see very similar, I guess, results as if you are losing weight, right? The problem then happens, though, is that the body's priority response to low energy availability is to adjust your energy expenditure to restore that energy balance at that lower energy intake. Does that make sense? So as a result, metabolic and physiological adaptations occur to reduce your total energy expenditure to prevent further weight loss from actually occurring, because there's now a new energy balance steady state. So I know that might sound a bit quite confusing, but basically that's why long term, when someone's suffering from LEA, they may be weight stable, or they may not necessarily be low in body fat, yet they have impaired physiological functions secondary to LEA. So that's why we can't assume body weight or body fat as an indicator for determining someone's risk of low energy availability.
Yeah, so what you're saying, Taylor, is that someone could technically be in low energy availability but still not losing weight?
Yeah, and I sometimes, most of the time, like to term it as walking fit. So the individual seems healthy. They seem, you know, a good stable weight or whatever it may be presented, but from a physiological perspective, there's a lot going on in the background that's problematic. So, and that's why you see a lot of the time we don't, or you shouldn't be using body fat as an indicator for that whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is super important for especially the weight category sport athletes, because you see this all the time in practice, and you would be familiar with it as well, where they claim that they're eating, you know, super low calories. You know, I'm training so much and I'm eating so low calories, oh, but I'm not losing weight. There's all this background physiological changes that are happening. What are some of these signs and symptoms of LEA that these guys can be looking out for?
Oh, I think we'll just quickly touch on what is low energy availability, because I've pretty much blabbered about it, but haven't actually explained that. So it's in great detail. So it's that imbalance between that energy intake and energy cost of exercise plus your daily functioning. So the way I like to think of it is, means that your body isn't receiving enough energy to fuel all the work that you currently want it to do, plus power basic functions, if that makes sense. So what your body does when it experiences LEA is it will dial down the non-essential functions in order to conserve energy. So I like to say this is thinking about your battery saving mode on your phone. So it's very similar to how the human body, as an analogy, if that makes sense. So when you start to reserve energy, what your body will do to compensate for survival is you'll notice things such as alteration or ceasing your menstruation, digestive issues, because basically what's happening is that your body's slowing down everything. So even your gastrointestinal tract and foods and how it's digested and vice versa will slow down. So you start to get those issues there. You get thyroid imbalances, obviously, because you're downregulating your thyroid hormones because of a reduction of your food intake plus the additional stresses from either psychological or training. We see a reduced immunity, obviously a reduction in our bone health, you know, poor temperature regulation, psychological disturbances. A big one is a reduction in our metabolic rate and, you know, impaired cardiovascular health. So you can see that there's acute issues there, and then obviously there's that long-term issues associated with it as well. But basically the LEA underpins you know, the female athlete triad, and I guess male athletes as well, which is now termed, you know, relative energy deficiency in sport syndrome.
Yeah, can we touch on that a bit more? Because that's a big topic as well right now is REDS. Just go over that again, the relative energy deficiency in sport. Can you explain what it is, and then how does this all tie together? And then, okay, well, ultimately, if we need to check these signs and symptoms, what are we doing about it if an athlete does find themselves in this situation?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people will be familiar that it used to be termed or categorized as a female athlete triad, and they've recently updated it to REDS. So previously that was because the female athlete triad was obviously identifying mostly females clearly with menstruation dysfunction, low bone mineral density, and obviously LEA. So they've now changed that to REDS because it needs to emphasize the syndrome affects all athletes, not just females. So obviously it takes into male counterparts now, and it's a larger umbrella that pretty much provides us a platform for a new approach to recognize, treat, and prevent this issue. So I guess when it comes to what REDS is, it's that LEA is the biggest driver of that, so low energy availability. So, you know, the lack of energy to support the range of body functions involved in optimal health and performance is significantly compromised, and LEA is what's driving that from the multi-system dysfunction, if that makes sense. So as a result, you know, the acute and long-term, but the body will basically downregulate the productions of hormones important for driving the adaptations to exercise. So obviously from an athletic perspective, that's not ideal at any level. So the disruption of the system will eventually lead to the reduction of effectiveness for training and performance. So, you know, and then it depends on how you then want to break it down from the umbrella aspect that we spoke about. So the relative energy deficiency in sport on an athlete's health has pillars that we focus on. And then also the athlete athletic performance is then significantly affected. So, you know, it's an endocrine problem, but then also too, from the athlete's perspective, they're going to see that decline in their performance quite significantly.
I want to ask you though, Taylor, like, from a practical standpoint, if you're taking on a new client, what are some of the things that you're going through? Or what are some of the things that you're looking for? What are the signs and symptoms that you're keeping your eyes out that, hey, these might be risk factors for this person might be in LEA, like sustained LEA for a long time? Or what are some things that are poking their heads out for you that you're keeping an eye for?
So when we're having athletes or individuals coming in clinic, usually what we do get them to do before they see us, is they fill out a questionnaire if they have any obviously medical or previous experiences that could be disruptive in terms of blood, so whether they've got thyroid issues or anything like that. One thing I do want to pinpoint though, when a lot of people say they get bloods to test their fertility hormones, is it's really dependent on where that female is in the cycle. Because if you're just getting the tests and just, you know, being like, oh, okay, wherever they are on their side, everything seems normal. But if you don't actually know where their menstruation is or what day they're in or what phase they're in, obviously that becomes problematic. So usually we get the bloods tested to figure out, you know, your iron, your vitamin D and all your vitamin like Bs and all that sort of stuff as well. Your thyroid hormones, we do check. In terms of their food, we obviously ask for a detailed within reason, because obviously, as we know, everyone isn't very good at diet histories. And we assess that based on also their training output. So it's really important that whatever area you're working in, you really understand that sport itself, because unfortunately, even clinicians can be, I guess, not able to identify an individual at risk of LEA or REDS because they simply don't understand the sport itself. So hence why we only work with strength and conditioning athletes. So we understand their training output, their training and competition schedules, and how that looks in terms of how much, you know, exercise, their calories they're expending per exercise as per se. We're also looking at the individual's knowledge themselves about their foods and how to fuel around their training, if they incorporate pre and post training nutrition, how they are with their recovery, all those types of things as well. Then we attach, I guess, a little bit of the psychological aspects. So if they have any unrealistic weight loss targets or body fat, I guess, you know, composition targets that they're aiming for and why, because I feel like you'd understand this too, particularly in a weight making sport, which is more so particularly within CrossFit too, aesthetics and that performance. You know, most of the time people want to be quite lean, but they compromise their performance based on that. But they both had those goals. And it's like, well, at the end of the day, you know, you need to prioritize what's more important for your longevity of the sport and understand the differences between those two things. And then obviously we touch on the risk of, as you'd understand, most athletes at some extent of their career have somewhat disordered eating patterns or maybe at risk of eating disorders, particularly in a weight making sport. So obviously we assess that too. And then you've also got to make sure that their general food routine is something you look at. Like I know I mentioned before about the diet history, but how much are they training? Are they doing double day training? Or when are they training? Are they unintentionally creating within day deficits with their foods? Do you know what I mean? So that's becomes quite common when a lot of people, you know, say, oh, I've lost my appetite after training, so I don't eat much after training, and then I do double day training. So, you know, that's a big red flag there. Another thing that we definitely touch on from a female perspective too is their menstruation. So obviously how long their cycle is, if they're tracking it, if they're on any contraception, anything like that, because obviously that's going to tell us a lot about what's going on from a normality perspective and what their normal looks like. So is it a 28-day cycle? Is it a 30? You know, how long their menstruation is, what the symptoms they experience, how they feel around training, all those types of things that we've got to kind of take in consideration, because if their normal starts to change, that's when it becomes problematic.
Yeah. And this next question I want to ask you, I was going to go back to the bloods and talk about, okay, when exactly do we have to do this? But I guess this ties in nicely of tracking their menstrual cycle and, like you said, understanding what their normal is. Can you give us a breakdown? What are the best ways that you would suggest or you have found in your own practice? Okay, you get this new client and you go, okay, I need to start tracking your cycle. How do you guys go about doing that?
So I find the most simple way for individuals is what they find isn't going to overwhelm them. So 9 times out of 10, if they have a smartphone or anything like that, just using a simple menstruation app to track their period is going to be most effective. There's a fair few out now that you can use. I always recommend Flow, which is quite easy because it tells you what phase you're in, when you're due to ovulate, and that type of thing, when your cycle prediction is going to be. And it allows you to assess any changes that you see. So I think whatever method you prefer, whether it's an app or whether I have some clients who like to do it manually, but it is something that we should definitely be more aware of, because so many females are unaware that their cycle is a big red flag if something is altered. And most of the time within the CrossFit world particularly, and I'm sure you heard this in the fighting world too, is most females are like, well, I'm lean enough, I'm not getting my periods, so that doesn't matter, because they associate with aesthetics that the leaner I am, the better it is, because of the fact that I haven't got my period, because it's almost like a period is considered almost like a pain in the ass in the making weight world, as you'd understand. But again, that comes down to knowledge deficit and them not understanding the importance of having your menstruation cycle present for when you are training and exercising and all those types of things.
That breaks down nicely into this next point. What is a normal period? How are you setting that up, or how are you increasing that knowledge gap with these guys and educating them? One, you're tracking the cycle and getting that, but what is it that's exactly normal, or what is it that you're using to map out a normal period for these guys?
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of like going back to high school physiology, if anyone remembers that. So as you're probably aware, or if you're not, that's completely fine. The textbook average cycle for most females is 28. However, we know the range tends to be around that 25 to 35 days. Usually when a client comes in, I do actually sit down and explain to them, you know, the cycle, the description of it, what we should be experiencing, so they can understand why we have a menstruation cycle in the first place. A lot of females aren't aware of how it occurs and the physiology behind it. So I'll try and keep it simplistic. But the way I like to explain it is, obviously it's split into two phases. So you have your follicular phase, which is also commonly known as your low hormone phase. And then you have your luteal phase, which is known as your high hormone phase. So your follicular phase pretty much starts your first day of bleeding. So basically what happens there is estrogen, which we know is estradiol in the hormones itself, starts quite low, and then it will rise with another hormone known as follicular stimulating hormone when that's stimulated. So the reason why estrogen will rise is because it'll continue to based on the maturation of an egg. So that's basically what the whole cycle is there. So when we get to around that, you know, day 12 to 14, that's when the egg is matured. And a lot of people would know this phase as as ovulation. So luteinizing hormone now kicks in, and he's produced by another bunch of hormones. So he basically allows a big surge to create the second part of the cycle, which is known as the luteal phase. What happens with the female after ovulation is the leftover follicle itself becomes, if any guys can remember this, the corpus luteum. So what that guy is, it's a temporary endocrine structure, and its role is solely dependent on whether pregnancy occurs or not during, obviously, ovulation. So the corpus luteum is responsible for producing the hormone progesterone. And now progesterone plays a really important role because it's responsible for stimulating the uterus to thicken even more in preparation for implantation of a fertilized egg. Okay, so what we see there is that the hormone estrogen is also elevated during this time to prepare the uterus for implantation. So if there is obviously no egg fertilized to implement in the thickened uterine lining, the body will then shed the lining, and that's what causes us to have our menstrual bleeding due to low estrogen and progesterone levels. And as a result, the cycle begins again. So I know that's like a lot to take in, but the whole important factor there is the hormones are so, intertwined and very tightly related. So if something starts to go wrong, you can see why during those phases, a lot of things can start to be disrupted and homeostasis isn't maintained. So that's why it's important to, make sure we are having those regular cycles and the tracking so everything can stay happy and okay, it's a happy medium, if that makes sense. Because when we're looking at it, estradiol itself, its main function is to mature and then maintain the reproductive system, whereas progesterone on the other end is important for ovulation to occur, so which is basically the main event of our period, right? So, and it's required for pregnancy and is necessary in order to have a true period. So, obviously, and also to the thickening of our uterine lining. So if you don't ovulate and you don't obviously produce corpus luteum, you don't produce enough estrogen, progesterone you need. So as a result, that's when you can start to have problems associated with defects of the cycle itself.
Yeah. And if everyone's listening and you can hear the thunder in the background, both Taylor and I are from Brisbane in Queensland, and it is sunny summer, which means it's storm season, so bear with us because it is crackling here as well. But anyway, Taylor, that's a really cool example, and I think let's go into this and let's talk about some of the dysfunctions, I suppose, of the menstrual cycle, because you hear about this a lot in practice, say like light bleeds or even just missing a period. Can you talk us through what are some of the common signs and symptoms that you see when it comes to menstrual dysfunction in regards to that cycle?
Sure, I'll try and speak loudly because of the thunder and the rain. But so there's a fair few that you can have. So there's ones known as luteal phase defects. So basically when your luteal phase is shorter than 10 days, and that's usually associated with reduced progesterone concentrations. And then you have anovulation cycles where obviously your cycles where ovulation does not occur, and that's usually associated with low luteinizing hormone and follicular stimulating secretion and reduced estradiol. So as you can see, there's a bit of a mouthful there. Then you have oligomenorrhea, which is basically what you were saying before when you're like, irregular and inconsistent menstrual cycles. So they can range anywhere from a cycle that's 36 up to 90 days in length. And then obviously you have primary amenorrhea when your menarche doesn't occur after the age of 16. And then you have secondary amenorrhea, which is no menses itself for, 3 months or longer. And then you fall into one, which is usually as associated from, the secondary one, which I'm sure you've heard of before and tends to be thrown around a lot lately, is a hypothalamic amenorrhea. So that's basically where a condition in which your menstruation pretty much stops for several months due to, a problem associated with your hypothalamus. And what that guy is, he's pretty much your control center of pretty much all endocrine systems, if that makes sense. So that becomes a problem, and it's quite common nowadays with a lot of athletes, because particularly females, obviously, who are underfueling, because most of the time I can guarantee you now, most females are, more underfueled than they are well fueled.
Hey guys, a quick interruption to the podcast to keep you up to date with what is happening with our latest supplement, Trainaid Hydration. Trainaid Hydration is a banned substance tested, dietitian approved oral rehydration solution that has specifically been formulated to promote rapid rehydration in the body. The best part about it is that our team of hydration experts have created it to be able to be dosed according to your specific hydration needs. Whether you're spending the day at the beach, playing golf, or getting those rounds in on the mat, you can trust that TrainAid will keep you hydrated. To find out more, head to www.trainaid.com or follow us on socials at TrainAid on Instagram and TrainAid Performance on Facebook. All right, back to the podcast. Let's talk about what that means. So bringing it back to LEA, and let's talk about the signs and symptoms. So obviously menstrual dysfunction is a big sign and a big screaming symptom of LEA. Is there a way that you can, say an amount of time that you find that say this will pop up, or is it extremely individualized to each person, or is this something that you see that's quite common with these say CrossFit or weight category athletes that are coming into your practice? Or is this a common thing that you're seeing in practice these days?
So I would say it's more common than it is not, particularly within, strength conditioning, CrossFit and making weight realms, just solely based on the fact that, you know, a lot of people think you need to eat less and move more. And that's what's driven in our society, particularly, the fitness culture. That's the only way you are to be successful, but without understanding how that has dramatic effects on our endocrine systems themselves, if that makes sense. So what a lot of people don't understand when it comes to, you know, LEA and that sort of thing, and from a reproductive perspective for females, is that what your body does is everyone's, metabolic stress handbrake is what I like to explain it, is different and unique to the individual. So, you know, someone might be having 2,500 calories and not be experiencing any issues with their menstruation, whereas another female could be eating exactly the same and all of a sudden they lose their menstruation. And in terms of anecdotal, what we see with that is that's what we can only put it down to is everyone's, metabolic handbrake is unique to their own system themselves. So it comes down to, you know, how much stress you're putting yourself under, both from a psychological and a physical stress, how much you are underfueling, and then what are you doing to drive that even further. So that's why it's really important to understand that when we see energy being shunted away from our body, because our body's basically like, well, we don't need energy right now to make babies. Our reproduction system isn't necessary. So we're going to stop that and cease that and move that energy elsewhere to basically keep our body alive and functioning. So that's where you start to see the cascade of metabolic alterations to conserve energy. So it's obviously not just an issue with the female reproductive system, but you see issues with your thyroids, you see issues with your leptin, your insulin, upregulation of your cortisol. And basically because, you know, these metabolic and endocrine adaptations occur with normal physiological ranges and are significantly altered during periods of low energy availability. And that's why it's really important to understand it can happen to anyone and that LEA doesn't discriminate. It doesn't discriminate based on your body weight, your body shape, your fitness, anything like that. So, most individuals are unaware of this. And this is what we're trying to communicate to a lot of, not just athletes, but coaches and other health professionals, that the long-term ramifications of this can be quite severe. But unfortunately, as we know, most athletes don't really care. They're just like, well, I'm competing, so it's not really necessary right now. But we're trying to say, yes, but your long-term issues associated with this severely outweigh what you're currently going on in your day-to-day life, but that doesn't sound as appealing, do you know what I mean? So, it ends up being more of a problem, definitely acutely, but also long-term as well, because it's not even just the physiological issues you see with it, it's the psychological problems that happen with it too. So, increased risk of eating disorders, depression, anxiety, all those things that go with the association of LEA and REDS itself.
Yeah, and I know I feel like we're beating a dead horse here and we're saying it probably for the third time, but all of this can happen whilst that person remains weight stable or could even be looking fit or could be looking like they're competition ready, right? So they could be in this state of low energy availability, still be weight stable, still looking fit, and all of this background metabolic noise and dysfunction still occurring?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
My mind goes, and we're talking about this and we're talking about a lot about the health side of it and the metabolic dysfunction. But like you said at the start, there's health and performance detriments to this, to being in this state of LEA. And where my mind goes is, okay, well, if you've got these hormones that are going up and coming down, there must be some correlation to how females who are training during these periods are feeling. Like, are they getting a better energy output at certain times? Are they getting, say, cramps that's hindering their performance? Can you shed some light into this? What is it? What do we know in the literature? What's there? What's out there? What have you seen in your practice? If we're following along with this cycle, are there certain times, say when the hormones are up, that's better times to do this type of training, or when they're down to do this type of training? Because ultimately what I want to get into is, if this dysfunction's happening, I would imagine there would be a lot of performance detriments that are coming secondary of this dysfunction.
Yeah, so just want to clarify in saying this, there was a recent systematic review brought out stating the effects of training around your menstruation, and that obviously is still a lot of research needs to be further validated in that aspect to be able to draw conclusions around that. So it is hard to be able to say, look, you know, most of the time we experience this and at this half of the cycle and vice versa, because we just don't have that evidence there to support that at the moment. That's why I say to individuals, it's really important that you track how you feel, and then you track when you notice things and if it is going to be a concern, and then we can just pull back or suggest, you know, training to be modified based on that, if that makes sense. So the research is still lacking quite significantly to be able to draw you know, nutrition interventions that are sound. So I guess that probably doesn't really answer that, but I usually work with the athlete from an individual perspective, from an anecdotal understanding based on the fact of how they feel with their cycle, and then, you know, do the best that we can to obviously enhance their performance within reason, enhance their recovery when they feel like they're going through a bit of a shitty phase in their cycle, and we adapt from that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, and it's a good, and the reason why I ask it is kind of get that disclaimer out of the way where, yes, okay, we appreciate that the evidence isn't right there and we don't know all of these things just yet, but that doesn't necessarily help people like you and me that have to sit across from these people and these females and these athletes and say, okay, well, you know, you're feeling terrible and I can't really explain why because the evidence isn't right there.
Yeah.
Are there anything that you have found in practice? And let's go anecdotal. We can move away from the body of evidence, and you could say this being one of the leading practitioners in your field. Anecdotally, are there certain things that you see like during this cycle that, and these can be common trends that say, okay, you know, at the high hormone phase, this tends to happen, or at the low hormone phase, this tends to happen. I know you said it's very individual, but is there any symptoms that you've seen in your practice?
So I guess it's going to be like you said, it's going to be individualized to the athlete, but we do see stuff anecdotally. Like most of the time females will complain just prior to their period that they're exhausted. You know, they get increased PMS symptoms. They get increased hunger, you know, those, individualized symptoms that they experience coming into the menstruation. And most of the time, as you'd probably hear, even with your fighters, that's when they're just exhausted and they just have a lot of trouble, I guess, being present in that cycle. Like I find personally myself during that phase, I'm not going to be able to hit my 1RMs or do anything that's going to be promoting a lot of strength just because I physically am exhausted. And you think about the luteal phase itself is when it's coming into those high hormone phases. So you have that disruption, or not disruption, you just have those, differences in terms of those hormones kicking in. So, you know, for me and my approach and what I've even seen from an anecdotal perspective, is that, you know, that's when you're best to incorporate, you know, things that don't involve a lot of, you know, coordination, doesn't involve a lot of thinking or anything like that. Like for me, I would be doing heavy snatches and clean and jerks during that time frame, you know, because of the fact that I just don't feel like I'm able to push myself to full potential, if that makes sense. And that would be very similar. Like, I don't know if you see that very similar with some of your fighters, obviously the coordination aspect that they need, they might be complaining from that side of things. Whereas the follicular phase is obviously the low hormones. You know, we just see sometimes females are able to hit you know, high intensity, they feel a bit better, they feel strong, they feel like they can get most of their PBs there. But again, like we say, it is anecdotal. That's just what we see in practice at the moment. So I guess within reason, you can kind of take that as a grain of salt, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think this is probably a good segue into a conversation we were having off air. And again, like we'll say, this is anecdotal. This is something that Taylor and I have both seen in practice. And yeah, the body of evidence may not support it, but I see it in terms of making weight and making weight for female athletes. We lose water weight, and there's a certain process that you go through, and there's certain numbers that you have to hit, and there's a process you put your body through to, say, quote unquote, flush that fluid out. And that's something I've definitely seen in practice that say, hey, during this stage for this individual, they will hold, you know, 1 kilo to 2 kilos of fluid. It's different for everyone, but it's something definitely be aware of. And I see that all the time when we're making weight, that, okay, we need to be very careful, or at least know this cycle well enough that when we're planning our competitions, okay, at this point you put on a lot of fluid weight, or you flush a lot of fluid weight, or, you know, we've got to sit in a bathtub or a sauna and you're going to be feeling terrible. Maybe we try to plan our competitions around that. Have you ever found anything along those lines with your guys, Taylor?
Yeah, and it is quite difficult. Like most of the time, particularly from a making weight perspective, you know, if they're due for their period or they're coming into being due, you're going to see changes in, you know, water retention in females, just because based on how progesterone works, and as it rises before menstruation, you do see that water retention occur. And not only that, as you'd understand, you've got that coming in and you've got stress itself with cortisol. So we know that stress has a profound effect on water retention. And you know this too, that cortisol interacts with the aldosterone receptor. So basically that's why water is retained even more so. So this becomes a problem when it comes to making weight, plus if they're due. So, you know, it makes it from our end quite complicated to be able to reassure them that they can make weight based on hormonal fluctuations. But that's why it's really important, again, further understanding how to track your cycle so we can put in, I guess, interventions to be able to deal with that when it comes to the time, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I guess we just come back to that point, right, where it's like, if you're a practitioner and you're listening to this and you're like, oh man, like I'm reading all these like OOC reviews and these position statements and I'm not really getting a lot. Understand your athlete, track their cycle with them and really get to know them and work with them on this, because these are things that you'll have to take in consideration, like especially if you're talking about making weight or sports like that. Hey, Taylor, you said a word there that I think is very important to talk about in this topic, and that is stress. Can you talk to us about how does stress fit into all of this? Say if someone is going through, say, this state of LEA, or they're going through and they're getting this hypothalamic amenorrhea, how does it fit into this whole puzzle?
So I guess like cortisol itself is like, it has positive things, right? So, you know, fight and flight syndrome and how it actually works. But I guess the problem when it comes to LEA itself and individuals is most of the time they're already under significant amounts of stress, whether that's psychological. Obviously the profound effects of under eating is more of a stress, but also too how exercise stresses the system out more, because basically what it does is, and this is the reason why I'm talking about this, because 9 times out of 10, as we know, most of the people coming through our door overtrain as it is, is that it stimulates the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. So obviously there's different ones of those. And it significantly increases basically what we call circulating cortisol levels as a result. And that rate can be proportionalized based on the exercise intensity and duration. So, you know, there is evidence to suggest that the moderate intensity, which is 60-80%, which I don't know about you guys, but most of our CrossFitters are above that all the time, will provoke obviously a significant increase in cortisol, and from a negative feedback loop that may also suppress the hypothalamus. So you've got stress coming in from an exercise perspective, and then how that works from an endocrine system, if that makes sense. And then also to an already stressed system when it comes to, you know, your hormones as per se, is that your body can't, I guess, keep it from a homeostatic perspective. So there's too much going on for your body to determine what's important and what isn't. And that's why we see whether it's an increase or a suppression of some of those hormones and the effects of that long term too. So, and that's why you get most of those individuals, athletes, and they say, I'm training really hard, Taylor, my food is really on point, and I keep cutting, but I'm not losing anything. And I'm like, because you're already further down regulating a system that is significantly stressed. So your metabolic handbrake is quite, already quite sharpened with that perspective. And like, how are you meant to, you know, continue and get results if that's constantly what's happening to the body itself?
Yeah. And I guess that's a lot of internal stress. And I'm sure you've seen this with your athletes as well. And I see this all the time with especially my females, males, all of them go through this, is external stress. And it's something that you see it, especially when you get up there, not even when you're up on the professional stage and you're going up and weighing in front of thousands of people. You could go through this even if you're an amateur or you're a recreational athlete and you're just putting all of that pressure on you. What kind of role does putting that external stress, or that stress that, not that you've put on yourself, it is there, it is a real thing, but that external stress, how does that fit in? Does that have a role in all of this? Does it affect the system?
Well, psychological stress is huge. So yes, I would say it would. And I guess that's why it's really important when we talk about, like, what do we identify with someone has LEA and what are the, you know, steps moving forward, is that by significantly reducing stress, that's going to be able to calm that system from a physiological perspective as well. So it's not just about one piece of the puzzle, it's about addressing all of them. So 9 times out of 10, if you figure out and identify what stresses you out the most within reason, and then put in interventions, it's just like, okay, so that's one part of the puzzle. Now we need to work on reducing your training, because that is also a physiological stress. So, you know, and whether that's reducing training or completely minimizing it is also another area that most athletes don't like hearing. And then obviously too, in that sense, is correcting the energy balance, because that is also stress. So you can see how, yes, I know you like to say, is it external? But all those factors can still be external as well as internal itself. So it's getting individuals to understand it's a whole picture we're looking at. We're not just focusing on one part of the jigsaw puzzle, if it makes sense, because it's not going to actually fix the problem, because we're not addressing the main concerns the athlete has. We're just like, okay, we're just going to, you know, most of the time you said to individuals, which I'm sure you've had before, take a week off training, which is really hard to do. But, you know, in a perfect world, in a perfect scenario, that would be, you know, quite phenomenal and help mitigate most of that stress because of the fact that you're allowing your body to recover and refuel and regenerate. But if you're constantly hammering a system on low energy, power saving mode, for example, as a battery, how do you expect to get any fitter, faster and stronger? And that's when I guess we see those problems associated on athletic performance, you know, where it's like the depression from psychological aspects, it's the irritability, impaired judgment. So all those things that affect the performance aspect, not just the endocrine systems.
Yeah. And I want to throw a question at you here, and I want to get your opinion on what exactly you do in this situation, because you said something there that is very, very common, especially in the world that I live in within combat athletes. And I'm sure you see this with CrossFitters and strength athletes and many, many, many other athletes go through this where they say, you know, I'm training heaps. I'm eating really well. I'm eating quote unquote clean. I'm watching what I'm eating. I'm watching my weight. But I'm still not losing weight. And I'm sure that's a situation that so many people listening have been in themselves. What goes through your mind, Taylor? If someone was to say that, can we run through it? Like, okay, what is going through your mind? How are you assessing that? And what is your advice to that person to get around that barrier?
And I think that's really good because you get the stages of behavior change that come in. But I think you uploaded an Instagram post today about athletic buy-in. And I think that's really important. And this is why you need to understand your athlete on all levels, because it's not just, obviously from a theoretical perspective, it's just like reduce your training, reduce, you know, your stress levels, eat more and voila. But that doesn't sound as appealing to an athlete when, you know, they've got titles or they've got competitions coming up and they don't really care from that perspective. So usually it's about communicating to the athlete. It's just like, well, you've constantly tried a calorie deficit and that's obviously not changing anything. If anything, it's adding more stress and you're not seeing many changes. So why don't we try the other end and slightly increase and see how that goes. But it's about also, you know, articulating that in a way that the athlete's going to understand that too, because most of the time, particularly if it's an aesthetic sport or weight making sport, the first thing they're going to associate that with is weight gain. And you know, you need to explain to an athlete, yes, you may actually see some increase in weights. You may not, because it's going to be individualized, but 9 times out of 10 weight gain does need to occur for that new energy balance to be normalized, if that makes sense. But it's about doing it in a way that they can always come in, and I utilize it from the athletic performance, saying, you know, if we do this, your performance is going to increase. If we do that, it's you're going to see these changes. But we also have to be very careful of how we say that, because, you know, if you give someone more food, what do they tend to do? Train more, which doesn't really help the situation when you're trying to get them to obviously eat more without having that increase in that energy expenditure. So I know that's kind of like a bit of a, you know, not really to answer your question to 100%, but it's going to be about understanding the athlete and ways that you can get them to understand how it's going to benefit them long-term, not just their short-term ramifications that they're currently experiencing.
Yeah. And I want to go back to a point that you just said there. And I think this is probably the fourth or fifth time we've said it in this podcast, but I'm going to continue to beat this horse because it's an important horse to beat. But you said, you know, 9 times out of 10, that does look like you have to gain weight. You have to increase your calories. Just run us through again. And I know we've gone over this, but I'm saying it again because it is important. These guys, if they're coming in and they are in that state of LEA or they've been in chronic LEA, they've almost down-regulated their system. And they can be in this state of, you know, they're not losing weight, even though they're training heaps and they're eating, you know, quote unquote clean, they're down regulating. Are you saying that, okay, well, you know, to get out of this and maybe to avoid some of these other physiological things that are going on in the background that are going to ultimately affect your performance, we need to up your calories. We need to either decrease your training. We need to up your calories. We need to change that energy balance or that energy availability so that you can get yourself out of this and increase that metabolism.
Yes, and that is correct. And it's really hard for people to understand that because, you know, that, like I said, it's associated with that whole gaining body fat perspective. But unfortunately, they've created such an impairment of those down regulations of the physiological functionings of the entire system themselves that, you know, they're not going to continue to lose weight regardless of what happens, because their body, from a you know, subclinical perspective of hormonal, thermogenesis and what's going on there from that perspective, that their body just won't adapt. And that's why it's really important that then they'll start to see those issues long-term associated with, cardiovascular health and those problems. But it is really hard to get them to understand that it's not, it's only for a short period of time. We've got to be able to get them out of that chronic LEA for their body to perceive them as being out of stress. And they say, and it's hard because someone says, well, how much weight do I have to put on? I'm like, well, how long is a piece of string? I was like, because you might need 1 kilo, you might need 2 kilos, you might need 3 kilos, but it's as much as what your body needs to perceive that's not in stress. And so the more you continue to fight that, the more you're going to be like this for a period of time because you're just not allowing your body to heal, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes sense. But now I'm just going to put my practitioner hat on and I'm thinking about this and I'm going, okay, like this makes sense. This makes perfect sense. This, I'm sure people listening here, if there's practitioners listening, they're going, oh man, this sounds so much like Sally and this sounds so much like Susie and even sounds like Bobby, you know? And well, as a practitioner, how are we doing this? Are there tools out there that we can go, okay, well, I think this is happening, but how can we assess this? Are there tools out there? Are there validated tools that we can be using?
Yeah, so there is one that's quite recognizable, sorry, and it's the REDS clinical assessment tool. So it's a risk assessment tool that is used to determine if an athlete is at risk of REDS, and it's based on like a traffic light analogy. So red light obviously being, you know, not ideal, not the best at all, sorry, and then yellow or amber being somewhat we have to keep out careful of, and green lights being obviously they're completely fine. So that isn't a validated tool, and it's what we can utilize, like I said, to identify if someone is at risk of that. And it's been associated and recognized by the Olympic committee, I'm pretty sure, in regards to that. And, you know, it's something that it goes into quite detail. You know, obviously the high risk, the red light is when an individual is at risk of anorexia nervosa, other serious medical conditions, use of extreme weight loss techniques. And then, you know, the moderate risk or caution is your yellow. And that's when they've had prolonged low body fat percentage, either by a DEXA scan, substantial weight loss, roughly around 5 to 10%. Don't quote me on that, I think, of their body mass in a month. And obviously there's other areas that we pay attention to with that too. So obviously if there's any abnormal cycle, menstrual cycle, they've had reduced bone mineral density, so there's a fair few categories that consider underneath that yellow light. And then obviously the low risk, which is that green light, is when they've had appropriate physique managed without, you know, undue stress or any unhealthy dietary exercise strategies, healthy eating, you know, appropriate with energy availability, healthy functioning endocrine system and healthy bone mineral density. So it is one that is good. And I think that if any practitioner is unaware of that and they're dealing with individuals like that, that it's something that I would definitely jump on board and have a look for the clinical assessment tool for that.
Yeah, fantastic. And to round out the episode, I did ask my social following to send me a bunch of questions. And when I checked this morning, there were a bunch there, but you know what? That was over 24 hours ago and I've completely lost them all. So sorry, everyone that's doing that. That's my bad. That's TFD's bad. But there were a couple that I do remember off the top of my head. One question that came through was recommended readings. I know there's so much information out there. And like we said earlier, we're not quite at the point where we can be saying, okay, this is a definite yes and this is a definite no. Like many things in science, we're not quite there. What are some recommended readings that you would say, just for even if it's practitioners or athletes or people who are very interested in this area, what would you recommend?
So there's Mountjoy. She's a researcher. She's phenomenal in terms of the female system herself. So that's a good reading, and she's obviously peer reviewed. Dr. Elliot Sale is another one. She's just done the recent systematic review on the training effects, and the contraception pill was also another one. And I believe for practitioners too, SDA, so Sports Dietitians Australia, have just brought out their version addressing the female athlete perspective. So that's also a good touch up on that sort of thing. But it depends. Obviously, in regards to the evidence base, it is hard to get access to most of those things being peer reviewed. But please, 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 if you're going to, make sure you work with an health professional that specializes in this area, and you don't just rely on social media to get your evidence in regards to this situation, because it can be more harmful than what it is providing any useful information to individuals?
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, because I guess in today's world, and I guess you and I kind of fit in this category, is we put out a lot of information on social media, but so do a lot of people. And I guess that's where a lot of people do get their information from. Taylor, if someone's listening to this and they do want to find like that, what are some telltale signs say, maybe this isn't the best information about this area? Maybe, you know, it's not as accurate it could be. Or, you know, on the flip of that, how do you tell like, okay, this is really good information?
I think it's, yeah. Welcome to the world of social media, right? Everyone's an expert. I think the hardest thing, you know, if someone's written something on evidence and they can't back it up or provide you with any of the references or anything, that's probably a big red flag for that area too. I think it's really important that whoever you're following and they state that they're a health professional of any sort or they have any other qualifications is to further investigate what those qualifications mean. And it's really important to, you know, understand that with whether things are credible sources or not. And that's really hard to depict on social media, particularly for when it comes to nutrition. So if anyone's, you know, not sure about, particularly from a dietetic perspective, obviously you have the SDA as well as DAA, where you can obviously look up individuals' qualifications and their levels there. But, you know, it is easier said than done. And also too, just if it sounds, this sounds like so ironic and so simple, but if it sounds too good to be true, it usually is. Like it constantly fathoms me how many people will send me things. But like, this person said this, and I'm like, can you just sit back and just read that for a second? And regardless of whether, you know, whatever, whoever that person is, that just, does that just sound like, does it actually sound like it's something that you would utilize or even in practice? Do you know what I mean? So it just frustrates me. But honestly, that I could go on for that about it for it forever, as I'm sure you could understand.
Yeah, I'm hearing you. And there's misinformation everywhere. But luckily, we do have people like yourself out on social media. And I guess that's a good way, if people did want to follow you, and which I highly, highly, highly recommend that they should, both females and male athletes, practitioners, or anyone who's interested in nutrition should be following Taylor. Taylor, what's the best way for them to hit your socials?
So obviously you can find me through Instagram. So it's just at @_sportsdietitian. Now dietitian spelled with a T, not a C. We're Australian, not American. And if anyone has any further questions or anything they want regarding this podcast, they can always shoot me through an email. And my email is also found on my Instagram handle profile too.
And the Sports Dietitian Co, probably one of the leading, if not the leading, sports dietetic clinic for CrossFit and strength sports in Australia. If you guys are taking on clients, how, if we've got guys listening and they go, oh man, I need to work with Taylor, I need to work with someone from her team, how can they go about working with you guys?
Yeah, so it's best to obviously shoot me through an email regarding that, and usually a bit of like background of what it is that you're particularly after. So we only deal, as you said, solely with strength and conditioning athletes. And if it's something that we can't look after or we can't cater for whatever reason, we always refer onwards to an individual so you are catered, regardless of whether it's myself or my team as sports dietitians or other sports dietitians that we obviously look up to as well. But that's the best way, so then we can determine you know, how soon we can get you in, what your goals are, and that type of thing as well.
Awesome. All right, Taylor, I won't take up too much more of your time, but again, thank you so much for coming on. That's super informative. Everyone listen in. I'm sure I'm going to go back and listen to that again. But everyone, if you're an athlete, if you're a coach, if you're a practitioner, anyone who's involved with female athletes, go through that again, read through it, listen through it, write down notes, read the notes, and go through it again. But Taylor, thanks so much for coming on, taking the time.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Taylor is one of Australia's leading sports dietitians, and her work in raising the collective awareness and education around energy availability is extremely needed. If you're an athlete who participates in a weight category sport, please listen to this podcast again and reach out to a qualified practitioner if you have any concerns about your health. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.